Thank you so much. Ho Zi Nian is, perhaps I may allow myself to say, his work in itself is interesting in terms of the systems of divisions. He shows equally in theaters, film theaters, festivals, Wiener Festwochen to Cannes, as well as in exhibitions. I was glad to have the chance to collaborate with him in recent biennales and other occasions, and he was here in Berlin on an invitation by the DAAD and stayed, about which we are very happy. And many years now, Zi Nian has been exploring in his particular transvisual and trans, perhaps narrative way, Malayan histories of liminality and origin. And I'd like to invite Zi Nian to the stage. T for tiger, T for theodolite.
Hello, good evening. And before I start, just wanted to thank all the other speakers for the really interesting papers. Thanks as well to Ansem and Pass for inviting me, and of course to all of you for staying. So I will jump straight into it. The title of my talk today is quite simply T for Tiger. It's actually broken up into 10 sections, so I guess it will be easy for us to keep track of how long it is. So section 1, Leaf. I thought it would be good to start with this particular image. This is a tree of life puppet known in Indonesia as the Kayon or Gunagan, and it appears at the beginning of a wayang kulit or shadow puppet theater performance, I guess much like the front curtain in a Western theater. The general design of this puppet, a tree within a leaf, functions to remind the audience that the whole is present in its parts, which I think is an important point for me to make as well, because this presentation is structured essentially as a series of 10 fragments from the long histories or stories of man and tiger interactions in the Malayan world. And it's illustrated with images that I collected in the last few years of my research, as well as some images from recent works that I produced. But before I go on, I would like to draw your attention to the scene represented on the leaf itself, which is a confrontation between two iconic animals of the Indonesian world, the tiger and the water buffalo, or kerbau in Indonesian. The clash between these two animals were, in the 17th century, something that was ritually staged as a public spectacle by the Javanese courts of the state of Mataram. But what the tiger and the buffalo meant depended on who was looking. In the eyes of the court, the tiger was a rival power. It was the king of wilderness and the lord of chaos. The court rooted for the buffalo, which stood for the solid values of civilization. To the peasant, the buffalo was plow animal. It embodied the life-giving force of agriculture. The tiger was untamed nature. But I guess that to the peasant, the tiger must have also evoked the court, the apex predator, which consumes without producing. The meaning of the tiger in tiger-buffalo fights would shift again in the age of Dutch colonization. The tiger now, for court and peasant alike, would stand for the European. We see the shadows of some puppets caught on a screen. This is actually a detail from the set of a theater performance that some collaborators and I made in 2014 called 10,000 Tigers. The Indonesian and Malaysian name for shadow puppet theater is wayang kulit. Wayang refers to theater, but it also evokes the sense of ghosts, shadow, or the imagination. Kulit means skin. And at one moment in the performance, the screen lifts to reveal the puppets carved from buffalo skin, traditionally with tools that were themselves made of buffalo horns. Then, at another moment in the performance, a projector turns on, using these puppets as support for a projected image, derived from an 1865 print of an original drawing titled Interrupted Road Survey in Singapore by the German artist Heinrich Leutermann. This drawing depicts a 1835 mission by the British in the Singaporean forest, a survey mission by the British in the Singaporean forest, which was disrupted by an encounter with the tiger. Within a decade, an all-out war between tigers and humans would erupt, which led eventually to the extinction of tigers in Singapore. In this image, we see the opposition between the civilizing mission of the white colonial surveyor on the one hand and of wild, untamed nature on the other. But in the local animistic cosmology, tigers were thought to be related by blood to humans in the distant horizon of an ancestral past, which means that this opposition between man and tiger was not something that was indigenous to the local system of thought. For them, tigers were regarded as vehicles or mediums for ancestral spirit. So shamans actually in Malaya, in Indonesia, but also around in Southeast Asia, were thought to have the ability to transform into tigers. So this is, in fact, one of the few things which I think truly links this pluralistic region, which is Southeast Asia. We find this myth in the Philippines, in Thailand, for example, with Apichapong's film Tropical Melody. We find this in Indonesia, in Malaysia. The dispersal of tigers across Southeast Asia took place more than a million years ago, long before the emergence of Homo sapiens. And when early human settlers first arrived in the region some 20,000 years ago, many of them favored as their habitat the transitory zone between the forest and the waters, an ecotone also occupied by other large ground-dwelling mammals like the deer and the boar, as well as the tiger that preyed upon these mammals. Humans did not yet have the capacity to dominate this savanna-like landscape, for which the tiger was so perfectly adapted. To live in such a terrain, humans had to attune themselves to the ways of the tiger, a process that brought about a kind of a fusion between the two species. What we have been looking at are actually video stills from Two or Three Tigers, which is an ongoing project that I began in 2015, featuring basically computer-generated figures or rigs that are animated by a human performer through motion capture processes. I guess they were kind of attempts to try to grow a kind of a were tiger with digital means. In parts of the Malay world, the tiger was believed to live in villages where the houses were said to be made of human skin and the roofs are thatched with human hair. So very often we find this focus, I think, on the skin, on the form as a container, a certain kind of separation between the body and the spirit. The first written record of the Malayan were-tiger comes from an early 15th century Chinese source, the Triumphant Visions of the Shores of the Ocean, which was written by a man called Ma Huan, who served as an interpreter to the great Ming Dynasty navigators and sailor, Admiral Cheng Ho or Admiral Zheng He, during the Ming Dynasty. Of his visit to Malacca, Ma Huan wrote, "In the town, there are tigers which can assume human form. They enter the markets and walk about, mixing with the populace. If anyone recognized one of these creatures, he would seize it and kill it. It was said that a tiger can dissolve itself into human shape in the midst of crossing lakes and rivers, which makes me think of how Bataille once described very beautifully the being of an animal in the world as that of water in water. Water is, in Southeast Asia, the prime element. It features in almost all its myths of origin. It is a liminal element, a lubricant for metamorphosis, which facilitates all kinds of change of states from inanimate to the animate, from the void to life. It is said that should a body of water not be closed at hand for the would-be were-tiger, he could instead perform three somersaults, drawing in the air the sign of the swastika, which is also the symbol of water, the whirlpool, and the eternal return. Let's return now to 1835, to the interrupted road survey in Singapore. This particular survey of 1835 was undertaken in preparation for a new road to be cut through the forest to accommodate the increasing number of gambier and pepper plantations that were brought on by rising European demands. Both gambier and pepper are cash crops that were highly destructive, requiring huge amounts of timber to process. Gambier involved the constant boiling of the leaves, while pepper required kiln drying, and this resulted in the destruction of the surrounding forests for firewood. Some animal species, such as the wild boar, thrived in this new environment with the extra foraging opportunities that such plantations offered, and thus also thrived the tigers that fed on these wild boars. But some tigers, of course, also began developing a taste for domestic livestock, like dogs and sometimes human beings. Miraculously, it was reported that no humans were harmed in this 1835 encounter with the tiger. Only the theodolite, which is the toppling instrument in the center of the image, was reported to have been destroyed to bits. The theodolite was an instrument for the measuring of the angles of horizontal and vertical planes, so it was a necessary tool for the rationalization of space that Coleman was spearheading. Coleman, in any case, I wanted to introduce him next, because this particular theodolite had belonged to him, to the surveyor, whose name was George Drumgo Coleman. Coleman was a highly accomplished civil architect and land reclaimer of Irish extraction. In 1833, Coleman was appointed both the superintendent of public works in Singapore, and he also became responsible, for example, for reclaiming large plots of land from the sea, from the river marshes, for extending the towns, and for designing many notable civic buildings in classic Palladian style, such as the St. Andrew Cathedral, which was the first church in Singapore. But Coleman was also at the same time the superintendent of convicts in Singapore, of the prison. So most of the convicts that Coleman had to deal with in his duty were Indians. They were responsible for crimes ranging from robbery, rape, riot, murder to political sedition. These Indian convicts were sentenced to what was known as transportation, which essentially meant a term in an overseas prison in other parts of the British Empire. But this was really also a life of indentured labor, because convicts were employed in all aspects of public work. They were involved in the draining of the marshes, the building of the roads, and actually also in the survey departments, where they served as chainmen, survey assistants, and land measurers, and that is where many of them also encountered tigers. It was precisely these Indian convicts that had made up Coleman's entourage in this survey of 1835. You see them sprawled around, scattered by the encounter. But it was also them who basically built all the buildings that Coleman had designed, including the first church in Singapore. In 1844, when brick, the prices of brick soared because of so much development, the colonial administration basically got the prisoners to even produce their own bricks to build the buildings with. In Singapore, in 1860, this is a story that I like very much, which is that these prisoners were assigned to the construction of a new building in the public square, and it was only when it was close to completion that they realized what they were building resembled a prison. You know, so they were basically building their own future prisons. But in any case, Coleman's twin duties of public works and the supervising of convicts conflated as a model of empire building that I would like to describe as Herculean, you know, in the sense that amongst Hercules' famous 12 labors were the very same symbols of economic development, the clearing of land, the draining of swamps, and the development of agriculture, as well as the domestication of livestock, the establishment of commerce, and also the introduction of technology. One of Hercules' most iconic mission was his second labor, the destruction of the Hydra of Lerna. When he lopped off one of the Hydra's heads, you know, two new ones grew in its place. As Linnabau and Radical noted, the Hydra in the European imagination stood for disorder and resistance, a powerful threat to the building of state, empire, and capitalism, and was often employed in parliament and in print as a metaphor for describing this difficulty of imposing order on an increasingly global system of labor. The life of one of these convicts could take the form of a kind of traveling without moving, because under confinement, they drifted across the Indian Ocean and circulated within Malaya. When Bencoolen, on the southwestern coast of Sumatra, was conceded to the Dutch by the London Treaty of 1825, 800 to 900 of these Indian convicts that were in a prison settlement there were distributed amongst the other three settlements, British settlements of Penang, Malacca, and Singapore. In Singapore, the prisoners were motivated by a system of reward and promotion, which meant eventually becoming warders over their own fellow prisoners before they were finally released into the colony as citizens. For many of the convicts, however, this was a journey of no return. The experience of this transportation was to be sent across what the Indians called the Kala Pani, or the black water, in which their former lives were to be dissolved forever, like water in water. The architecture of the prisons in colonial Singapore differed from the radial plan of the panoptic model that was kind of an ideal in Europe. Rather, the prisons in Singapore resembled the system of the dormitory, which, in other words, treated the prisoners as workers. And they were homogenized with their diet and also their labor regimes. Prisoners of all castes were mixed together, which the administrators considered an advantage and protection against all possible combined revolts, for it was their cynical belief that no one caste would invariably betray the other castes. So in this kind of convict shops where these convicts were put to work, the convicts thought of these shops as what they called the Jeta Junaza, or living tomb. These Indian prisoners of all castes were mixed so closely together that for a person of caste, it meant constant defilement and thus perpetual excommunication from his own kin. The Singaporean prison had a reputation for being progressive in the ways that it could put the convicts to work. It was basically the first Indian jail to introduce a steam-powered sawmill and pulp mill for manufacturing. A printing press was used in printing and bookbinding and published documents for various government departments. J.F.A. McNair, the Comptroller General of Convicts, wrote in his memoirs, 1899 memoirs, which also tellingly titled Prisoners, Their Own Warders. He wrote that upon learning photography in 1861, he taught photography to two literate convicts, whom he put to work in a specially constructed photographic studio inside the Singaporean jail, which provided services to Europeans who needed to take photos or portraits. But out of these, studio was also produced a series of photographs of their fellow prisoners. Some of these photos, the original photos can't be found, so they only remain in McNair's memoirs. So basically, these pictures included various categories or types of convicts, from fifth class incorrigibles to first class overseers, timekeepers, and clerks. So basically, the Singaporean prison was had a certain kind of reputation for being progressive. So its aim was to eliminate the need for all external warders, so that basically the prisoner could survey themselves. So it was really the most efficient kind of system built in the true spirit, I guess, of British pragmatism. As Claire Anderson, the historian, noted, these photographs that were generated sort of unconsciously mirrored the ethnographic projects that were simultaneously underway in the Indian subcontinent as well as in British Malaya. In 1899, the English anthropologist Walter William Skeat entered deep into the forested heart of Malaysia. In 1906, he published his major text, which was called The Pagan Races of the Malay Peninsula, and it included in it the first photograph of a Malay were-tiger. So I've always been quite fascinated with this particular image. It's always apparently only one of the two men was a were-tiger. It was the person on the right, I guess, my right, which is your left. Yeah. So, but it's an interesting kind of a decision to have the two of them, as though there is something kind of like uncountable with this were-tiger. But in any case, by the 20th century, belief in the were-tigers have become relegated to the realm of folklore, following the widespread upheavals of landscape under British colonial rule, as well as the tiger extermination campaigns, for example, which was carried out in Singapore soon after Coleman's encounter with the tiger. Nevertheless, I think that tigers continue to exercise a great hold over the imagination of Southeast Asia. They continue to haunt the imaginary landscapes of this region, So what I'm going to do now is basically kind of a quick, succinct kind of tracking of the afterlife of the tigers after their physical extermination. In December 1941, the Japanese 25th Army invaded Malaya. Moving swiftly through the forest, they were savage, they were amphibious, they were able to move on land and water quickly, which surprised the British that were fighting them. And they were also known to be very savage and full of guile, full of treachery and tricks, you know. And so if you observe this, the way in which the Japanese troops were described, it actually resembled very much the qualities that the British projected onto the tiger kind of a century before that. Anyway, the Japanese 25th Army was led by General Tomoyuki Yamashita, who was actually widely known as the Tiger of Malaya. And Lieutenant General Takuma Nishimura, the second ranking officer, was also widely known as the other Tiger of Malaya. Well, the principal resistance in Malaya against the Japanese occupation was actually the Malayan People's Anti-Japanese Army, which was essentially a guerrilla organization under the leadership of the Malayan Communist Party. So when the Japanese forces surrendered in 1945 and was in the midst of leaving Malaya, We found that the name of the tiger or the usage of the tiger as a metaphor got transferred from the Japanese to these communist guerrillas. We see in public, in the press or in many discourses, the description of communist guerrillas as some kind of tigers. So, for example, when the first independent prime minister of Singapore, Lee Kuan Yew, who only passed away last year, when he was describing his time of gaining independence with Singapore, in which he entered a short period of collaboration with the communists before he arrested them. After that, you know, he described the process as one of being, we knew we were riding on a tiger, you know. So very often you see these metaphors kind of returning. So in some sense, even with the physical sort of extermination of the tiger recurs as a metaphor incessantly, you know, in my parts of the world. So in any case, you know, as I mentioned, When the name of the tiger was transferred to the communists, the communists actually constituted now a very real threat to the British colonials who were returning after the war. Of course, they were weakened by the war, and the communist guerrillas in Singapore possessed basically weapons that they were using to fight the Japanese. But nevertheless, the communist guerrillas lost the struggle, and they eventually retreated from the cities into the forests, where they essentially they ended up taking shelter in the forest, which kind of in the Southeast Asian world, the forest is the shelter of myths and magic and animals. So in some sense, I think of the communists has kind of going back a certain kind of a full circle, becoming tigers. The British actually, to counter this new retreat of the Malayan communists into the forest, they began by intensifying the regulation of forested zones, offering cash bounties, organizing hunts and ambushes. And all of these were basically the same techniques that was used in the extermination of you know, tigers a century before. But sometimes, in the shadows of these dense tropical forests, the British hunters of communist guerrillas sometimes found themselves coming face to face with real tigers. Yeah. So this was also recorded in some memoirs of the soldiers, you know, who were involved in this operation. Yeah. So I guess with that, I would like to end this story of the tigers. Thank you.